It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few minutes, our guest tells the unfinished story of Tibet, its mystique in the West, its years under Chinese rule, and what the future might hold.
First, a corporate research tower designed by Frank Lloyd Wright is now open to the public at business headquarters in Racine. Chuck Kornbach reports on the famous architect's attempt to create an inspiring and practical place to work.
Get Wright to design an administration building for the company in Racine. To hear Johnson Company Global Community Affairs Director Greg Anderegg tell it, the two titans did not exactly see eye to eye.
Mr. Johnson came back and wrote in his journal, he insulted me, I insulted him, he did a pretty good job of it.
But Johnson did respect Wright, and the two men also bonded over a model of automobile they both drove. Eventually, Wright designed the Johnson Administration Building with its famous so-called lily pad columns. There's also the well-known home for the Johnson family, Wingspread, which is now a conference center. Both have long been open to the public, but a third building, constructed on the Johnson Company grounds in 1950, the Research Tower, is about to make its public debut.
So why don't we go up to the third floor? This is the only stairwell.
Anderegg leads the way up a narrow stairway to one of the two floors in the 15-story research tower that have been renovated for people to see. The floor looks like a lab from the 1950s, complete with venting hood.
So it would have had gas coming into it and power and water, and then air could be evacuated out to be filtered before it was released. So you'll find these on every floor, these venting hoods.
Sean Malone of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation says it's extraordinary that S.C. Johnson is opening the research tower for free public tours. Malone says the site shows off a side of Wright that you don't see in his homes, places of worship, or other types of buildings.
This is the only research tower, yeah. There are other significant office buildings. The Larkin office building in Buffalo was very significant, but from almost half a century earlier. And so this is the opportunity for people to see that.
And Malone notes the Larkin building has been torn down. About 30 years ago, S.C. Johnson moved its research to a nearby building, but at Wright's Tower, the firm displays some of its well-known pesticides, cleaners, and other chemical products that were developed there. Though these days, some people may be trying to cut back on using household chemicals, Greg Anderegg says it's justified to show off where some items were created.
Well, I don't think we make any bones about the fact that we make chemicals. But we try to be a environmentally conscious, a sustainability conscious company.
The research tower has another meaning to Brady Roberts of the Milwaukee Art Museum. Roberts says the numerous windows of the tower help show how environment influences work.
You can't help but understand that a beautiful workplace with connection to nature is going to be a more pleasant place to spend time. You know, the opposite would be if you're in a workplace that's dark and dingy and unpleasant, you know, you're going to not be inspired.
Roberts is curator of a Wright exhibit called The Two Taliesins, also opening tomorrow on the S.C. Johnson property. According to the company website, the tour slots for the research tower seem full for the first few weeks. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tibet has captured the attention and imagination of the West for decades, even centuries. And in its 60-plus years under Chinese domination, it's been the subject of Cold War espionage, international diplomacy, and political protest here in the United States.
But how did Tibet end up under Chinese control, and what does the future hold for the Tibetan people? Our next guest tells the story of Tibet in the international arena.
Leslie Brown-Halper is with us. She's a Tibet scholar, a research associate at Corpus Christi College at Cambridge, and co-author of the new book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you both for having me today.
Well, your book contrasts the mystique that Tibet has in the West with the difficult political realities. Let's start with the Tibetan myth, in a way. Why did people in the U.S. and Europe became fascinated with Tibet over the years?
And as you just said, our book is really about two Tibets. Mm-hmm. So one of these stories is about their quest for independence. And in a second dimension, it is the story of the Tibetan myth. And some of your listeners might know it's the longest enduring myth in the West. And it started in the 5th century with Herodotus, a Greek historian and scholar who found gold-digging ants on a high mountainous plateau. And it goes all through the centuries, really, until it comes till about 1904 when it was opened to the West through the Brits with Sir Francis Younghusband. But we really see the myth take hold here, say, in the West and the rest of the world. The West will say, and in the United States, in 1933 with James Hilton's book *Lost Horizon*, and then you see Shangri-La and the myth of Tibet really become part of the vernacular, and people become enamored with this otherworldly place. Where we're talking about telepathic lamas and all this mysterious goings on, and then you really see take hold.
And alongside that myth, as you say, there's the political reality. And there's been a long history of great powers competing for control or at least influence in Tibet. British and Russians, U.S., China, India, the list goes on. Why has it been such a battleground of international politics?
Well, it really the British really controlled most of Lhasa since, as I mentioned, 1904 until the Chinese invaded in October of 1950. But there was intrigue. The Brits, of course, thought that the Russians were coming in there. But I think that these countries became involved because Lhasa was a small, insular, and naive government. When they finally realized that the Chinese were going to invade, they looked to India, they looked to the United States, and then they looked to Britain for help. And these countries eventually became involved, but it was very difficult. The United States was preoccupied domestically and had other priorities abroad and really couldn't help. Britain post-war was constrained financially. They couldn't help. And then there was India, who had inherited all the rights and obligations to Tibet in 1947, and the Indians believed that their security and required that they cooperate with Beijing. So the Tibetans were looking to these great powers, but really didn't get very much help, overt help, I would say. But in 1956, with the Eisenhower administration, finally the United States gave covert assistance in a very romantic, daring operation in Tibet.
We'll get into some of that in a bit, but on that eve of the Chinese conquest, after Britain had given up its colonies in South Asia, was there a widespread belief, apart from in China, that Tibet would be an independent country at that point?
I don't. The Tibetans always wanted their independence, and various times throughout their history, they have been independent. They've had this priest-patron relationship with China, and the Tibetans clearly believed that they were independent. They wanted this, but I don't think that the United States, Britain, India ever believed that the Tibetans would be independent. Clearly, when the Brits had control, they acknowledged that the Chinese had some sort of suzerainty or relationship over the Tibetans. And the United States looked to Britain, and they deferred to Britain on what if Tibet had sovereign rights or could get independence. And then there was Prime Minister Nehru, who said, nope, we're not really going to do anything about this.
So China launches a military occupation, as you mentioned, in 1950. They did not describe that as an invasion, but as a domestic issue. Why did Communist China say, in effect, hey, Tibet is and in effect always has been part of China?
Well, that's a very good propaganda effort on part of the Chinese. I think that this is all part of the revisionist propaganda of the Chinese. And, of course, they believed that Tibet had always been a part of China, and they wanted it back as part of the motherland, much like they wanted Taiwan. And they really wanted, at the time, the resources in Tibet. I think it was a huge plateau, not very populated. They wanted the uranium. They wanted the minerals. They wanted the water. And Mao made that clear when he spoke to a young Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama was 15 years old in 1950. And when they met, he made it clear to that young Dalai Lama that, you know, you have a vast land. We have a lot of people. We need the resources in Tibet. And they were prepared, really, at the time to do anything to make sure that Tibet was secured for what they called as part of the motherland in those years.
And the United States has had, it seems, an ambivalent role through this time. As you mentioned, espionage efforts to help Tibetan resistance in the 50s. But alongside that, always the hope that we, the United States, could detach China from alliance with the Soviet Union, so we didn't want to go too far to ruffle their feathers. Is that right?
We just were really constrained, as I said. I mean, we were constrained. The United States at the time was just, we had other priorities. Let's look at what happened. We'll say in the 1950s, the United States, both the Truman and Eisenhower administrations, they were limited domestically and geopolitically. Let's say domestically, they had the Henry Luce, the China lobby, and they had the Catholic Church, all believed that the United States had to support Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists in order to thwart the communists. And so these administrations needed the nationalists in order to fight the communists, and the nationalists, like the communists, believed that Tibet was part of China. So there really wasn't anything that the Americans could do then overtly. And then the U.S. was constrained by the geopolitics of South Asia. And at the time, Washington believed that India would offer the best hope for regional stability. But not only were relations between Washington and Delhi very strained, as I mentioned earlier, the Indians were going to cooperate with Beijing. In terms, they shared a 2,000-mile-long border, and they weren't they believed their interests were best served by not doing anything about Tibet.
We're talking about Tibet's past and future. We'll get into the role of the Dalai Lama, a unique figure in many ways on the world stage. Our guest is Leslie Brown Halper, her new book is Tibet, An Unfinished Story.
You can join the conversation. Do you have a question about Tibet? Have you been involved in Free Tibet activism? And do you think Tibet gets enough international attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after this look at the latest news with Noah Ovshinsky. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about Tibet's past and future with Leslie Brown Halper, co-author of Tibet, An Unfinished Story.
You can join the conversation. Do you think Tibet should be an independent nation? Do you think the United States and other countries should work to help that happen? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or call in with your questions about Tibet. You can also email talk@WPR.org. Leslie, I want to talk about this unique role of the Dalai Lama. How has he evolved as a figure of opposition to Chinese control of Tibet?
I think he's in a very, very difficult position. While he would like to see more for Tibet, he originally, when he left in 1959, he came to India, and of course he repudiated this 17-point agreement that said that Tibet was part of China. And he at the time said that, yes, the Tibetans wanted independence. But of course, that has been tempered over the last decades. In 1988, with the Strasbourg Accords, you know, he called for autonomy. Whether or not today that would be possible, it's hard to say because it's very difficult. Many of these Tibetans are integrated now in Tibet, in Lhasa. So the Dalai Lama's role is a bit controversial. There are some in Dharamsala, in the diaspora community, who would like to be more forceful against the Chinese, the Tibetan youth movement most particularly. And the Dalai Lama tries to call for peace. He tries to placate in some ways the Chinese. So he's in a difficult position right now.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to know what level of influence does China have in changing the demographics in Tibet. He's heard of a push by China to push out native Tibetans, settle Han Chinese there.
Yes, that is correct. I'd like to put it this way. In 1950, when the Chinese went into Tibet, we would say that it was 100% Tibetan. In 1911, when the Manchu dynasty fell, the Tibetans had basically expelled any of the Chinese that were there. Now it's maybe 60, 70% Han Chinese. They do call it a type of colonization, a transfer of population into Tibet. You know, Mao and going forward to today, they've made it very, very clear that they want the Han Chinese in Tibet. And this is where you see much of the unrest and that you would find, especially in Lhasa, which today is under a lockdown. These Tibetans are not getting the jobs. They're not able to use their language skills because they don't have higher education in Tibetan. It's very difficult because the Han Chinese have come in. They've opened stores. They get the better jobs. The Tibetans have become, in a sense, marginalized.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Wade on the line in Milwaukee. Wade, hi.
Hello.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Wade?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for covering this topic. I think it is critical for our species. It's a litmus test on the quality of our thinking, on our humanity demand. And so I absolutely endorse the idea that the international community and the global powers should be focused on resolving this. And I wonder sometimes why instead we seem to focus so much on a Middle East situation, in Israel and Palestinian situation, rather than over in Tibet. Why the disparity in these two situations that have some similarity?
Wade, thanks for the call. Why is the Middle East front page news and Tibet isn't, Leslie?
I think the Middle East is more important to the United States and to other countries geopolitically. I think that the United States, has a trade relationship with China. I think the U.S. finds itself in a very precarious situation. Every time the Dalai Lama comes over, the president is not allowed to meet with him in an official capacity. And I just think that the issue of Tibetans and human rights has sort of been relegated, way down to the bottom of the list. And like your caller says, I wish personally that it was a more important issue. But we're not talking sort of Middle East peace process between two nations. We're basically talking about Tibetans that are many of them who have assimilated into China, talking about getting their independence. But much of that independence movement has been quelled and silenced, so the world really doesn't hear about it as much, say, as the Middle East. And Israel, of course, and the Arab populations, it's an important issue for the whole region, as I said, geopolitically, whereas Tibet doesn't hold that sway right now.
Wade, thanks for the call. We've got Tom in La Crosse on the line now. Tom, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious. China has approached Tibet very aggressively. Why have they not approached Mongolia the same way?
The Mongolians have seemed to have assimilated much more easily than the Tibetans. And it's not to say that they didn't have some of the same issues, but I think that the Chinese have been very, very surprised over these past decades that the more that they try to bring in infrastructure and throw money at the Tibetans, the Tibetans still want their independence. The Tibetans have their own language, their own culture. There's a sense of nationalism there, and that even after six decades, the Chinese cannot sort of stamp out the myth of Tibet and the Dalai Lama, who's out there and he's promoting peace, and he's a very visible figure, and it makes it very difficult for the Chinese to make this issue go away, because clearly it's not going away.
If there's a protagonist in your book, it is the Tibetan people. What is their life like? How are they enduring after these years, decades under Chinese rule?
I think it's a very, in that sense, is a very sad story. We've been up there a few times. I've done many interviews, and you always feel your heart really goes out to these people. Again, as I just mentioned, they really are under Chinese rule. For example, they're not allowed to practice their religion. They're not allowed to have a picture of the Dalai Lama. That's an instant prison sentence. So, and one of the most important aspects of any culture really is language. And so there is, they're not practicing their language. Mothers that I spoke to said that that's very sad. There's no oral history happening there because their history books have been changed to reflect a sort of a Chinese-authored history of Tibet. So the people, it is very difficult. At this moment, Lhasa, for example, is on lockdown. Most of the people don't have passports, are not able to travel. You know, they're quite desperate to have the world know about their situation. So I would say that it's very sad. And again, the world is not hearing about what's going on with the Tibetans because the Chinese are very good at monitoring this in this sort of authoritarian government.
We'll leave it there. Leslie, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Leslie Brown-Halper. She's a Tibet scholar, research associate at Cambridge, and co-author of the new book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a fitness writer about new research showing a link between exercise and increased creativity.
First, we're talking about a new report from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance that says Wisconsin is about to undergo a huge demographic shift that will affect employers, taxpayers, government, and the ability of the state's economy to grow over the next 30 years.
Todd Berry is with us to discuss the new report. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
So what is this big demographic shift we're looking at over the next quarter century or so?
Well, this is not mysterious or anything. We have a lot of baby boomers who are maturing and getting ready to leave the workforce. And anybody that's been watching school enrollments for the last decade or two knows that the number of young people has been declining in the state. And when you put those two together, what you end up with is a state workforce that is not going to grow at all over the next 20 to 30 years.
So we're aging, fewer people in the labor market. What might that do to our economy?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth between partisans over job creation and economic growth, but really fundamentally, if you don't have more people, you can't create jobs because you don't have any people to put in those jobs.
And it seems like that might be a good news scenario for younger people. There are fewer of them to go around for
sure.
The existing pool of jobs. So maybe unemployment would go down in that scenario?
Yeah, you'd expect that the wages would be bid up, that unemployment would be low. It certainly would be, Wisconsin would be an attractive place for people to come to in terms of employment. But again, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem because if you don't have the people, then you can't have the jobs.
Right. So an employer might say, I need to start a new factory. There are no workers in Wisconsin. I'm going to go elsewhere. I'm not going to go to Wisconsin.
Yeah,
to do this.
That's certainly one possibility. Or, you know, they maintain their operations here and decide they need a second plant or whatever somewhere else.
And is this uniform across the state or affecting more areas than others?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is differential in its impact, but in some ways, it's surprising at how widespread it is. There are only going to be, I think, in the next 30 years, about 21 counties out of 72 where the labor force is going to grow, and only four where it's going to grow 10% or more. In other words, the vast majority of Wisconsin counties are going to see their workforce size be static, and in a fair number of them, the decline is going to be 10% or more. If you look across a great part of northern Wisconsin, part of that central Sands area, part of the southwest, Those are the areas where the labor force is expected to shrink the most. And that's not surprising in a sense, because that's where we've seen school enrollments falling for a decade or two.
What does this mean for state government? I mean, in part, they'll also have a smaller pool for labor. Mm-hmm. But what about revenue if we see this declining pool of workers?
Well, you know, one thing about the baby boomers, when they were born and grew up and so forth, there were houses built and cars purchased and appliances bought and children clothed and school enrollments growing. And it really was very much an engine for economic growth. And if you have a workforce that's static, you're not going to see as rapid total income growth. There are not going to be as many new households forming where they buy a lot of these big durable goods that generate sales tax revenue. So I don't think you're going to foresee going into the future the kind of robust state tax growth that you saw, say, in the 90s when we were growing 6, 7, 8, 9% per year.
As you say, this isn't a secret or a mystery. We know it's coming. We see it off in the distance. Knowing that, is there anything we can do about it?
Yeah. Well, we put out a report 10 years ago titled Wisconsin 2015, where we outlined this issue. So,
And we fixed it between now then and now.
Yeah, we sort of missed an opportunity there. But there are certainly things you can do. First of all, you've got to make sure that you graduate and educate well every possible young person from high school. We just can't afford to have higher dropout rates in some districts. It certainly is an opportunity to continue to tap in flexible ways the expertise of retiring baby boomers. It also offers an opportunity to try to lure back to Wisconsin natives who perhaps wanted to stay here, but because of their college educations in business, finance, information technology, or whatever, there simply weren't enough openings for them. And so that would be another source. We're going to have to talk about in-migration, and that means immigration, too. If we didn't have to worry about the federal government, I would say that state political and business leaders should be waving a magic wand and starting to look at other countries that have well-educated, high-trained labor forces that we could go after, in a sense.
So chasing after not just within the country, but international immigration
international,
to Wisconsin.
Yeah. I mean, we've known for some time that certain sectors of the U.S. economy wish they could import more people of high skill and high education levels.
One sidebar to this, you mentioned school districts earlier. We already see this problem in counties with declining populations, districts with fixed costs, the size of their school buildings and that sort of thing, but declining enrollments and thus declining state funding. Do you see this as a growing problem in the future as well?
Well, we already have that problem. We've had it for since the late 90s, and because the state limits revenue growth in part based on enrollment, we've had smaller, isolated school districts under the squeeze in terms of revenue for some time. So for them, it's just going to be a continuation of what we've already known.
So you did this report 10 years ago. You're doing it again today. Do you think lawmakers are taking this issue seriously? Are they looking that far into the future and trying to come up with a formula to fix that now?
Well, whenever I talk to people that work in the Capitol, lawmakers, lobbyists, whatever, one of the first things out of their mouths is always, this in a full-time professional legislature, the time horizon is very short. It's the next election, and so they really don't have. Even if they have the will, they don't have the capacity to think long-term and strategically. So it is a challenge, but it's one that is so pervasive It doesn't touch one party or one region. It should be something that collectively state leaders can work together on.
Well, maybe we'll check in with you in the future to see if they're doing that. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Todd Barry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, talking about a new report showing how Wisconsin's aging population could hurt the state's economy.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. At this point, we all know that exercise is good for our bodies, especially good for our brains. But here's something I didn't necessarily know. A short walk around our office could help boost our creativity.
Gretchen Reynolds is here to break down some new research proving that exercise can increase our creativity. Gretchen is the phys ed columnist for the New York Times Well blog. Gretchen, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So like I said, you know, we've heard that exercise is not only good for our bodies, that it does good things for our brains too, but creativity is a new angle on all of this. What do we know about how exercise can improve creativity?
Well, you're right. There have been a lot of studies that have looked at the link between exercise and various kinds of thinking and have shown pretty persuasively that exercise can improve memory and other types of thinking. But until this new study came out, no one had really specifically looked at whether exercise could affect creativity. And so researchers at Stanford developed a really interesting way of examining this question. They gathered a bunch of college students, because they're readily available on the Stanford campus, and they brought them into a very boring room, and they deliberately made it boring so that there wouldn't be anything stimulating in the room itself. And then they had the students first sit at a desk and perform a series of tests that are designed to study creativity. And one of them, which I thought was pretty interesting, is they had to very quickly come up with new uses for a very common object. And in one case, it was a button. So they had to just sort of throw out any ideas they could come up with about how to use a button. And then the scientists had them perform the same test with a different object while they were walking on a treadmill, also in this office. And they were just staring at the wall ahead of them and walking on a treadmill and throwing out ideas for how to use a button or whatever the object was. And it turned out that just by walking, they were about 60% more creative. They came up with a lot more and much better ideas when they were walking than when they were sitting.
60% is a lot more creative. I mean, it's not even just a little bit more creative. What's going on there?
Well, the first thing is the study then went on, and this was important because it wasn't clear whether you would be more creative only while people were walking, which would mean that we would all have to have, you know, treadmills in our offices or, you know, perform walking meetings. So they next had the kids, a different set of students, either sat and did the test and then sat and did it again, or and then sat, and they were still very creative when they sat after walking. They were still about 60% more creative. So the results definitely lingered. And they also lingered, which was, again, quite interesting, even when the people did not go outside to walk, which a lot of us would probably think that we'd be far more creative, just think better, if we went outside for a walk than if we stayed in our office and stared at a blank wall. But that wasn't true. They actually were just as creative if they walked on a treadmill in an office as if they went outside and walked around the beautiful Stanford campus.
Well, so it's really just the movement itself. It's not really fresh air, sunshine, you know, endorphins of being outside, nothing like that. It's just moving.
It appears to be the walking. And they were just walking. They were walking at whatever pace they felt like going. It wasn't jogging. It wasn't anything strenuous. It was just a very, essentially, easy stroll that people did for about, the test tended to run for about 8 minutes, so it wasn't lengthy. And as a result of that really small amount of activity, they increased their ability to come up with creative ideas just enormously.
So what do we know about why that happened? Does it have something to do with increased blood flow and maybe oxygenation to the brain?
Possibly. That's a good creative idea.
And I'm sitting down.
Well, this study was not a formal neurological study, although the authors do hope to do one in which they will have people wear, you know, functional MRI caps and try to see what's happening in their brains. They didn't do that this time, so it's just speculation. But the authors think it may have something to do with blood flow. It may have something to do with raising people's moods, that it's almost a side benefit of people feeling happier when they're walking, and that's somehow changing their ability to think creatively. It may be that there's something about the physical movement itself that sparks activity in certain parts of the brain that are related to activity. That will be studied next, but the almost immediate takeaway is, if you need to come up with good ideas, go for a walk.
Well, it's a fantastic idea, but most workplaces aren't geared toward walking. If I started walking around our little square of an office space up here, people, I think, would think that was really bizarre. It's hard to get outside at all. I mean, do you think this is going to change workplace culture?
As a matter of fact, yes. It certainly has. This whole idea has been sort of percolating in a number of businesses, particularly in places like, say, California, for a while. And the whole idea of walking meetings has become very trendy. And people do, in fact, at a number of large corporations, they do make an effort to get people moving during the workday. But most of the support for that has been purely anecdotal. People would say, I think I actually, you know, think better and come up with better ideas after I walk. But their bosses would say, hey, that you're procrastinating. Now, there really is scientific backing for the idea that people will be more productive. They will think better. They will come up with more creative ways to work if you allow them to get up and move. And it doesn't require a lot of equipment. You don't have to have treadmills in people's offices. Let them get up and stroll down the hallway. This study would suggest that any amount of movement is likely to spark creative thinking. And that's really, I mean, I find it wonderful to think about that.
It is a really interesting thought. We tried this out a little here on the Central Time team last summer on, I don't know, like a 99-degree day. We went for a walking meeting, and almost half of us thought we were going to die during the walk. So I don't know if it was a success for our particular team, but that could speak more to the Wisconsin summer than anything else. I wonder if you think that, I mean, people who work in offices should petition and say, look, we are going to be more creative. We need to get outside.
I would say yes. And you can expand from that to you don't have to get outside if the weather is miserable, if it's raining, if the humidity is 120%. This study suggests that you don't need a landscape. You don't need nice weather. All you need is the movement. You need to stand up. And yes, I would much rather go outside and go for a walk than stare at the wall in my office. But if your goal is simply to start thinking better, it appears all you need to do is stand up and move. And you don't have to go outside. You don't need the sun. You just need to have your body moving.
What do you make of the fact that it was just this really mild strolling that correlated with a 60% jump in creativity? Because it seems like lately when we hear about exercise science, you really have to go gonzo, you know, all out, high intensity interval training to get any kind of, you know, real payoff. Why is it such a mild form of exercise? I mean, do you think that if we're running ultra marathons, we'll be even more creative?
Probably not, actually. I mean, there is some evidence that people think less well after strenuous exercise, and that's because simply their bodies are fatigued. and that is reflected in the ability to think. To me, this study makes perfect sense in terms of what we know about human evolution, because in terms of our, you know, far-off ancestors, if they sat around and didn't pay attention to things, they became someone's lunch. If they got up and just moved around a little bit, paid attention to what was going on around them, came up with creative ways to get away from whatever was chasing them, they survived and passed along their genetics. That was not running marathons. That was getting up, moving, going for a walk. It would make perfect sense that that amount of exercise, which is really quite slight, can affect how well you think, how well you come up with creative ways to solve a problem. Whereas running a marathon is not going to have the same benefit because it does make you physically and mentally tired.
And Gretchen, our last 30 seconds here. Last week we had a guest on who said that sitting is the new smoking. So this exercise creativity link, is this just going to add more, you know, weight to that argument that it's time to stop sitting so much and get moving?
Yes, I think there's no doubt about it. I think it does very much add to a growing body of evidence that we are not meant to sit. That if nothing else, if you can't manage to go for an 8-minute walk, at least stand up and stroll around your office every 20 minutes or so. It will improve your health. And this new study seems to suggest very strongly that it will make you more creative and a better employee.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Gretchen, we're out of time. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Sure, it was my pleasure.
That was Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the Well blog at the New York Times. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. Stay tuned. There's more to come.